Hello and welcome to Talking Therapies, a podcast made together with Psychologies Magazine and the UK Council for Psychotherapy, or UKCP for short. I am Susie Walker and I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Psychologies. Each month on Talking Therapies, we will be talking to a UKCP therapist about a range of topics. Prejudicial treatment of people based on age, sex or race can have a profound impact on mental well-being. Even though laws have been put in place to prevent discrimination, it still presents many challenges.
As a black male psychotherapist, I'm extremely busy. And my practice is full of people from all sorts of ethnicities and genders. So from my perspective, I'm not convinced that people, let's say black people in this example, are reluctant to seek help. I think what can happen is they're reluctant to seek out help given that the system is actually very white and middle class. That then creates a barrier.
That was UKCP psychotherapist Dwight Turner. Prior to training as a psychotherapist, Dwight served in the Royal Air Force. During his deployment in Germany, he became interested in understanding the prejudice and racism that underpinned his childhood. Now working in private practice, Dwight is a senior lecturer at the University of Brighton and is completing a PhD research into understanding psychotherapy and human nature from a cultural perspective. In this episode, UKCP CEO Sarah Niblock is sitting down with UKCP psychotherapist Dwight Turner to find out how psychotherapy can help those who face discrimination and also those who practice it.
Dwight, I wanted to start by asking you, how does discrimination impact society as a whole?
Well, it's a good question to start with. We've seen through things like COVID-19 and the lockdown and the impact on the BAME community. I'm going to use the term BAME, even though I'm not necessarily a fan of it, but just to keep things simple today. The past few years, we've had the Me Too movement and so on, and even things like climate change and disability politics and so on. We see that there are many disadvantaged groups who don't feel that they have the same rights as those of privilege, be it the able-bodied, be it those who are white and middle class, be it those who are men and so on. And the cost of that, the impact of that on society is that we have a lot of communities who feel sort of left out, marginalized, silenced, disadvantaged. And that can lead to things like the impact on people's mental health can be greater. For example, the LGBT community. I was reading a paper just the other day about how COVID-19, the lockdown, has really highlighted and impacted on the LGBTQ community's mental health to a greater extent than perhaps the national average. So discrimination and inequalities, they do have a far greater impact than perhaps we're even aware of a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading the research that's come now. We're recording this in August 2020, and the research that's come out now about mental health and lockdown, and even the easing of lockdown, did not impact positively on certain groups. And those are the ones that you're describing. They are women, particularly women caring for children, BAME people. And like you, I find that sort of acronym a little bit problematic sometimes, but also people living in urban areas as well.
Yeah. Well, I think you also raised an interesting point around the position of women during lockdown. We've fallen back into some very old stereotypical roles in the home. You've got working women who are still then charged with looking after the kids, given that the father's at home as well. It's a very odd thing to happen.
I'm interested to know, from your perspective as a psychotherapist, as a black psychotherapist, what you think the protests say about the possibility of change. I'm a white woman. I don't claim to have that insight that you have, and I'd be interested for your perspective and how positive you feel about the Black Lives Matter protests.
Well, I think for myself, I'll start off by saying there's a level of cautious optimism, and I'm using that phrase for a reason. George Floyd's murder and the protests around the world, not just in the States, around the world, against anti-black violence, is not just about police violence, but anti-black violence, has really brought back to the surface for myself just how oppressive and how difficult it is to be a black individual or group in the modern day and age. Talking about this now in August, of course, I've had a couple of months to sort of start to process what went on. I remember when I first saw the videos, feeling really quite saddened, emotional, and angry at what was happening. This is nothing new. People will focus in on the fact that it's just, it's one incident. Yeah, he was a criminal, all those sorts of things. But this is not just about one individual. This is about a regular occurrence of systems of oppression that Black people endure all the time. And for me, these sorts of protests, not just from within the Black community, there's a growing awareness that actually this needs to stop. And I think if we actually harness this energy, this power, this drive to actually not force change, I don't think you force it, you're just going to end up with a backlash. But if you can encourage and pull change along the road, then actually there is a chance for something different to come into play. My fear, though, is that lots of people just jump on the bandwagon. Now, we saw it with Black Tuesday, where lots of companies, for example, put up blackout and supporting Black Lives Matter and so on for that one day, but then who've gone back to perhaps doing exactly the same things they were doing beforehand. And that's my fear for all of this. We've been here before. So if there's going to be change, let's make it a sustained effort towards that change. We've had the big start gun, if you like, of the 100-meter race. How are you going to run the next 30 or 40 meters of that race? How, what are we actually going to do to actually keep this change going? If we can put things in place, then there's a possibility for change, in my view.
Such a good analogy. You've talked the talk, but now you've got to walk the walk and actually be measured on what you've said. We do know there is plenty of data that those who experience discrimination, that there is significant fallout. Black people are much more likely to be sanctioned under the Mental Health Act. But also that groups from a variety of ethnicities and cultures who are less likely or seem less able to seek help. Is it that some people are just less likely to access support? And if so, why might that be?
This is an interesting one. As a Black male psychotherapist, I'm extremely busy. And yeah, my practice is full of people from all sorts of ethnicities and genders. So from my perspective, I'm not convinced that people, let's say Black people in this example, are reluctant to seek help. I think what can happen is they're reluctant to seek out help, given that the system is actually very white and middle class. That then creates a barrier. And I think, you know, there are plenty of non-majority sort of counseling organizations that are also fairly busy. There's something about trying to challenge that sort of stereotype that actually there aren't those avenues for minority groups to access counseling, whatever else. What part of the answer is actually more services for minorities, because there are many different ways that one can feel like an outsider. So therefore, how we actually build services to meet those demands is quite important. We can't just have a one-size-fits-all. I think that's where perhaps mental health and psychotherapy has perhaps gotten a bit caught in a bit of a trap, seeing things through a purely Western white lens, which has then led to people feeling actually they can't access those services because it's not for them. So the more that actually psychotherapy evolves, the more that we're able to meet these sort of diverse communities.
Yeah, and meet people where they are.
Yes, and as therapists, we're actually challenged with doing that on a day-to-day basis. Where we've gotten slightly stuck is, it's not just ourselves, this happens across the Western world, but as a community, if you like, as a profession, we've struggled to actually work out, okay, how does working with that particular minority group, be it Black men or Black women, how does that actually differ? And how can we develop those sorts of skills? That needs greater research, which will need resources, but there is a chance here to actually develop and grow the trade, if you like.
Now, as you said, discrimination, it comes in many forms and can affect a variety of people. As psychotherapist, how do you find that an intersectional approach to discrimination can help us to understand the complexity of this kind of abuse?
Yeah, well, this is a very important point here, because I think, again, lots of our courses have barely scratched the surface around difference and diversity. We've sort of gotten stuck within, say, the 9 protected characteristics of the Equalities Act. That's fine, but that's a very narrow start point. And I think what intersectional theory actually brings into play is that actually difference and others has always been incredibly complex because it is very difficult to get a handle on. For example, think about things like identity. Now, my identity is not just the 9 areas of the Equalities Act. You know, I'm an academic, I'm Black, I'm male, I'm divorced, I'm a father. Those are aspects of my identity. Often when we're talking about discrimination, people will just see me for one of those. They see me as a man. So they're therefore, okay, they'll be afraid of me because of that. They'll see me as Black. Maybe they'll put the two together. So what intersectionality actually does is it actually explores the fact that we're actually oppressed from a number of different areas. So as I'm black, then I experience levels of discrimination from that perspective, for example. As a black man, I put those two together in a white environment, then I experience levels of discrimination because of that as well. I'm seen as a threat in some ways. I'm seen as somebody who should be avoided, where people have to cross the road to actually get away from me, that sort of thing. The more that we can understand the complexities of power, of privilege, and of otherness, the better we can actually work with those in the therapeutic space. Our trade is majority white. And yet lots of those counsellors, especially when they're in training, be working on the ground with people who are from different backgrounds themselves, be it class-based, be it age-based, be it because they're able-bodied and their clients are disabled. It could be anything. The levels of power play built within that, if they're not seen through an intersectional lens, they're going to get missed. And that could also potentially re-traumatise our clients around difference. That's something we need to try and avoid, but we can only do that when we understand it to a greater degree.
And what impact does discrimination have on our mental and physical health if we don't address it?
Well, this is the thing. I think being black in a white environment, we often don't feel we can actually be ourselves. So we put on a cloak. I'm just using that as an example. I'm sure there are many other ways of exploring it. Maybe through your own lens, Sarah, as a woman, what is it like to work in a sort of more patriarchal environment? We can't always bring the fullness of who we are to the environments that we're existing in, out of a fear of annihilation, out of a sense that we've been told that's not acceptable, we've got to adapt in some way. My parents were very adept at acting British, for example, when they came over from the Caribbean back in the 50s and 60s. So they learned to adapt. The cost of that, though, is we know about a false self. You develop like a racialized false self, this sort of double consciousness, the idea that actually we can't be our full selves. We're having to adapt to the environments that we exist within, but there's going to be a psychological impact of that. The thing about discrimination, though, there are studies out of the Caribbean, is when we experience discrimination, that can lead to greater levels of obesity, greater levels of depression. I also think it goes a bit deeper. And as therapists, we have, again, a duty to start doing a bit more investigation as to the psychological impact of this. You know, I'm doing lots of work around dreams. And I think these experiences become internalized really deep down into the unconscious, whereby even the dreamscape for those of us who are a minority is altered by experiences with privilege. For example, you know, my dreams are often littered with experiences of whiteness whereby I'm feeling oppressed in some way. And I have to work through that in my own therapy so that I can understand, okay, what have I taken on from the environments that I exist within?
Very powerful. And the way that you've articulated that repression of a whole section of a person's identity in order to be able to function within a particular culture is absolutely heartrending. Now, discrimination can be absolutely overt. I mean, obviously, the protest being a testament to that. But it can also be very subtle, can't it? It can be that sort of fleeting microaggressions, micro-discrimination. How can we equip ourselves to identify when it's happening to us or others?
Again, this is a very important point. I'm going to start with the idea of splitting. For example, if I get clients who come in and they've endured some sort of microaggression, let's say around race, and often what I find happens is they start to split between the felt experience of what's happened, which is one that they're annoyed, they're angry, they're upset, whatever else, and also an attempt to try and normalize it. They're just making a joke about it, or maybe I didn't understand it. There's an attempt to cognitively avoid the full impact. And my job as a therapist then is to actually try and hold the two parts together. Because I think that's another layer of the more subtle layers of discrimination that we don't always understand. It's the emotional, cognitive dissonance that's created by an experience of othering, if you like. Let me give you an example. I wanted to write a paper on early life material, but I wanted to make it a bit more Afrocentric. And I was terrified. I spoke to a tutor about it and they said, well, you could do that, but maybe you need to stick within the guidelines because that's what this course is all about. And I felt sort of semi-unseen. I felt, okay, it wasn't okay for me to bring a sense of blackness to that paper. So I went away, talked about it in therapy for a good few weeks. I had to really wrestle with the urge to do what I wanted to do versus what I've been told to do. In the end, I wrote what I felt was right for me because my therapists were actually able to hold the two parts and sort of from swinging backwards and forwards too much. And the essay was fine. It passed. It was great. Not a problem at all. But the struggle to actually align those parts, to not go into a place of falseness, to actually come from a more authentic place, I think is really quite pronounced when we've endured some sort of discrimination, where we actually judge ourselves. We've internalized that it's not okay to be black on the page or in my workplace or whatever it is, that I have to conform to some sort of projected way of being.
And the effort that's involved, that additional effort when compared with your contemporaries in that situation, is acute. You know, this is a conversation I've had with a number of our psychotherapists in similar situations who say it's just the sheer day-to-day, daily effort and energy that is expended because I'm black. It's something that I hear all of the time.
And I've written about it as well. It's tiring. If you're doing that on a day-to-day, literally hour-to-hour basis, it is tiring. And that was the other thing about the whole George Floyd incident, in my view, that what came up for myself and for many other black colleagues was actually the traumas that we put to one side and we sort of, inverted commas, forgotten about, then come to the surface, and how tiring that is as well to actually have to revisit some of those. We put them to one side because that's the way of surviving the environment, because you can't stop to actually process this. But actually at that moment, given that we're on the lockdown at exactly the same time, there was no other option but to actually say, okay, I've got to look at this now. I have no real choice. It's hard work existing in a world that's not your own.
Do you give people strategies? I mean, if somebody has experienced discrimination, do you give them some kind of strategies to deal with that in some way? I say deal with, it's not the best choice of words, but to confront that and to and process that in themselves?
I think what I might do is I might point to resources where they can get support and help if need be. There may be more legal means that a client or a service user needs to go down in order to get the support that they need in order to take on the organization that they're working for or to challenge whatever it is that they're having to deal with. So I will sometimes point to legal resources to their union if it's a workplace. I'll refer them on to different organizations that where they can get some additional support. And I think sometimes we have a duty to actually support clients go through that.
I wanted to go back to something that you actually mentioned earlier, how your unconscious mind is trying to process incidents of racism. Could you talk a little bit more about that, perhaps the kinds of ways in which discrimination appears in dreams?
Fits in with something I mentioned earlier on about how we internalize experiences. You know, lots of people who'll be listening to this podcast will know, okay, it's early life stuff. That's where it starts in a way. But this goes on all the way through one's life. We internalize things all the time. And one of the things I'll look at with some clients is, okay, what's going on in the unconscious? What's going on in the dreamscape? If they're black or from a minority group, how does privilege and otherness play out in their dreams? For example, I wrote a paper just recently around experiences of systemic racism where about my own dream sort of scape was populated by characters who were very oppressive towards myself, and it was very difficult to find my voice. And actually writing the paper was a way of actually taking that power back, if you like. So I think these sorts of experiences can come up unconsciously. What the dreamscape will actually play out is the trauma of othering, the trauma of experiencing racism, homophobia, sexism, whatever it might be. That will be held in the dream as well.
Well, how have you found that psychotherapy can help someone who is experiencing discrimination?
I think it comes down to a couple of things. One, therapists probably need to be more aware of their own prejudices. Those therapists who are perhaps quite racist or being raised in environments whereby racism has been normalized. It's not to say that every therapist is racist. That's not what I'm trying to get at here. But what I would say is that if one's raised in an environment whereby, let's say you went to school and you saw on the page that actually Africa was filled with people who just wore loincloths and swung from trees, and you watched Tarzan movies when you were a kid, then that sort of becomes internalized. So your view of blackness resonates with that. Or if you're used to watching or seeing that actually all black people do is drive around in flash cars and wear lots of bling, those sort of stereotypical images inform one's idea about what blackness actually is. Therapists can get caught in this like any other group of believing that actually that's who I have in the chair opposite me. When that's not challenged within their own perspective, then they can act out something with the client whereby their own fear, if you like, of blackness then flows into the room. And what can often happen is then clients just leave, but they're not really sure why they're leaving. And the therapist isn't sure why they're leaving. They're just pathologized or they've just left, as opposed to looking at actually, what have I done in order for that person to feel they can't quite sit with me? Too often though, as therapists, we're a bit defensive around things like race and difference. and therefore we choose not to even look at it. We hide behind things like All Lives Matter because of that fear, that embarrassment that we might be complicit in somebody else's oppression.
I wondered if psychotherapy can help someone who is discriminating against others.
One of the avenues that I would go down is looking at, okay, how can we in our trainings do a better job of exploring these difficult topic areas, paying a little bit, not to sound too critical, but we sort of tokenize explorations of difference. We sort of stuck within the confines of the protected characteristics, and that's fine, that's important. But actually, this is more about privilege and otherness and the power dynamic between the two.
Yeah.
I think that's quite important. So I'm not so worried about changing people's mindsets because everybody has their own route. This is mine. It doesn't mean that everyone's got to follow the same route as myself. What I am interested in is actually people being more honest with themselves as to where they're coming from.
Yes, for life, absolutely. The recurrent thread, I think, in so many conversations that I've had with UKCP psychotherapists, it's that acknowledgement, it's that incredible self-awareness and that understanding how your past, your origins, or your experiences very much shapes who you are. You may have some shame in that, but that is held. And I think what's been so useful about this conversation is you're not attributing any blame. You're not attributing any shame. There's a sense of acceptance in what you're saying. It feels very holding. I don't believe you criticise any one group or individual.
Yeah, it steers away from the need to sort of project blame. And like you said, shame can be bounced around like a bit of a ball. I'm more about actually holding. Actually, shame is going to be there, but also pride. Why wouldn't one be proud of one's identity of origin, for example? It could be that, you know, I'm proud of being a black man. I like the fact that my parents were in the Caribbean, celebrated every year at Carnival. Why shouldn't somebody who's white and English celebrate the fact that they like St. George's Day? But it's about being aware that actually those positions are okay to hold. But that's the one thing about the political version of political correctness is that it silences that sort of debate, that sort of discursive sort of exploration of, you know, what is it like to be white, English, black, a woman, a man, whatever it might be.
Well, these are very interesting but painful times, I think. But I feel very heartened and positive having heard what you've said, Dwight, and I'm sure many listeners will find that incredibly inspiring, actually. So thank you very much for this and for sharing your precious time at such a very busy period. Thank you, Dwight.
My pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
That was UKCP psychotherapist Dwight Turner talking to Sarah Niblock, the CEO of the UK Council for Psychotherapy. If, after listening to that, you feel you could benefit from some talking time with a psychotherapist, then go to the Find a Therapist section of the UKCP website and have a look through. The website address is www.psychotherapy.org.uk and look for the Find a Therapist tab. We'll also be discussing discrimination and its effect on mental health in Psychology's magazine this month, or you can find us online at psychologies.co.uk. We'll be doing a podcast each month with some of the UKCP psychotherapists, so remember to like and subscribe to our channel to hear it first. It also helps others to find us too. So join us again next month. Till then, thank you for listening and take good care of yourselves.